This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And welcome to our reprise series of Lifetime Income. When we were looking at some of the programs that we wanted to cover and sort of repeat, one of the things that really stood out to me that we covered earlier on during the year, and I think it bears repeating, and that's the dollar crash portfolio. The dollar has not crashed over the last couple of years. In fact, it's remained strong. And if you're looking at currencies, it remains one of the strongest currencies on the globe, and it's getting even stronger, especially with the Fed's recent announcement that it's going to begin taper. What is it going to crash against? Is it going to crash against the euro? Is it going to crash against the yen? They have more problems over there. If you think QE is a problem here, realize given the size of Japan's economy, the QE that they're going through now with Abenomics is almost three times the size that we're doing here in the U.S. So it bears repeating because a lot of you have set yourself up for this dollar crash that you've been told is going to happen, and it hasn't happened. Hasn't happened in the last decade. Now, we saw the dollar decline in the last decade, and we saw it decline, let's say, from 2010 to 2011, but it's strengthened since then. So we're going to touch upon this sort of doomsday prepper program that has brought so many losses to so many portfolios. And we're going to discuss, do these portfolios really make sense? And folks, never forget the importance of diversification. So if you are in that situation, what should you do now? We're going to cover that in this repeat edition.
In the second half of our program today, we'll be revisiting an interview that Jim did with Carolyn Rosenblatt, who's the author of the book, The Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents. And I think a lot of the boomers out there listening, you know as well as we do, that you are in a very unique position right now. You find yourselves in many cases supporting not only your parents, but your kids, which is why they keep calling you the sandwich generation now. But in this book, Carolyn Rosenblatt talks about how to talk to your parents about their own preparation for their health care and for their retirement, because the bottom line is what they've done to prepare themselves for end of life is going to impact you and your finances. But these are kind of tough conversations to start and tough topics to cover. So we thought it might be helpful for you to hear one more time some ideas and thoughts about how to talk to your parents about these really tough topics, planning for end of life in terms of finances and health care. Do you guys remember when Jim and I talked about doomsday prepper portfolios? You know, portfolios that were mostly in gold and in cash? Well, we kind of have a related scenario for you this week, the dollar crash portfolio. Do these portfolios make sense? Are they set up to do what you think they're supposed to do? Jim and I are going to sit here today and help you figure this out. So Jim, I asked you if we could cover dollar crash portfolios this week because I'm still talking to investors who are just waiting and waiting and waiting for that to happen. And so they have their portfolios poised to, at least as they think, cash in on the dollar crash when it eventually comes. And I've noticed that as a trend, most of these portfolios for people who are big proponents of dollar crashes tend to be pretty heavily weighted toward the following. They're heavily weighted toward commodities, especially toward precious metals. They tend to have high investments in foreign companies, or they hold investments on foreign exchanges, and they often hold foreign currencies. So Jim, if you don't mind, why don't we go over talking about the thinking behind a dollar crash and how likely a dollar crash is to happen so our listeners can decide for themselves if having a dollar crash portfolio really makes sense right now.
Well, if you think about it, what's the thought process that goes behind a dollar crash? And Kathleen, as we went into the crisis, which began in the U.S. with our mortgage credit default swaps, the dollar fell and commodity prices went up. But when the financial crisis hit, believe it or not, the dollar became stronger. Now, the proponents of the dollar crash believe this will then lead to one, rising interest rates causing the U.S. to head back into a recession, hyperinflation. I would say most people expect higher inflation, but the dollar crash people believe it's going to be hyperinflation. Number three, devaluation of the dollar against other foreign currencies. Four, a steep reduction in the U.S. consumption of foreign goods, which means we would be importing less, which would be helpful for the dollar if you think about it. Five, competitive devaluation of their currencies by foreign governments. So for believers in a dollar collapse, they're really talking about the death of the fiat currency system overall. And more importantly, as you talked about, as they put their money in, let's say, foreign companies, foreign currencies, they've been killed. I mean, the dollar has been stronger. The U.S. markets have been stronger. And all of those things, I mean, what's the dollar going to be replaced by? It's not going to be replaced by the euro. It's not going to be replaced by the yen. And it's certainly not going to be replaced by the Chinese yuan. So for believers in a dollar collapse, you know, when it really gets down to it, they think the whole fiat system crashes, which doesn't make sense. If you think the dollar is going to collapse and you're in another foreign currency, that foreign currency is going to go down and probably down even more. And we saw that when the Fed began taper talk this year in May, the markets that got hit the hardest were the foreign markets.
Well, when you talk about having, you know, a dollar collapse lead to the collapse of basically pretty much every fiat currency system out there in the world, I mean, that seems pretty scary to me if all the fiat currency system collapsed. Wouldn't that mean that the whole financial system would collapse too?
Oh, absolutely. That's the theory. And it's why most proponents of a dollar collapse are also proponents of owning precious metals, especially gold. The thinking is that when paper money fails, people will return to real money, gold. I just don't see that happening right now, and we're not even close to it.
Well, Jim, I remember when I first started working for you about 10 years ago, you were pretty heavily invested in precious metals for your clients. Well, that and energy too, right? But now our clients' portfolios are only what I would consider to be only modestly exposed to precious metals and commodities right now. Why the change?
Well, there are a number of factors. Number one, think of the run-up to 2011. What were we dealing with in 2011? In the spring, it was Fukushima. It was the Arab Spring. And then, of course, the infamous debt ceiling. And then, of course, we were dealing with the pig countries and the crisis. So that was number one. Number two is as the emerging markets began to slow down, and especially as we're seeing that today with China, India, Brazil, there was less demand for commodities. Commodities were in a topping process. You look at commodities across a broad spectrum. I don't care if you're looking at precious metals, if you're looking at energy, if you're looking at base metals, you're looking at agriculture, they're all down this year. And so what we see in a sequence when a market tops out, whether it's 1999 to the year 2000 or it's 2007 to 2009. The first thing that happens is bonds peak first because inflation has heated up, but a central bank is raising interest rates. The second thing to peak is stocks because when the Fed begins to raise interest rates, they're saying, hey, we don't need to keep things loose anymore. The economy's getting better. Stocks are the second thing to peak. And then finally, commodities peak. So if you take a look at 2000, the commodity market peaked, the CRB went down, gold and silver went down. Take a look at 2007 and 2008, commodities peaked in the summer. And during that financial crisis leading all the way up to its bottom in March of 2009, Kathleen, gold went down, oil went down, commodities went down. So if you follow the way people think, that's not the way markets work. So the more diversified you are now, I think the more better off you are. That's why I think that you see a broader spectrum and why we've talked so much about diversification here and why we've emphasized stocks over, let's say, commodities over the last 3 or 4 years, because the process was topping out, especially with precious metals in 2011.
Well, Jim, I know that you've mentioned that you don't really see any big drivers for commodities or for gold right now. So you talked a little bit about what's changed since 2007 and 2008 to change the drivers behind commodities and gold, but would you mind talking about that just a little bit more?
Sure. I mean, China, if you take a look at the last decade, what were the big stories? It was the emerging markets led by China. And as these economies expanded, as China's economy went from backwater to the second largest economy in the world and it industrialized, it was ramping up its consumption of commodities during that time. Now, China is experiencing slower growth and is on the verge of a bursting bubble, especially real estate. You take a look at India. India's central bank is raising interest rates to cool off their economy, as is the central bank of Brazil. So their consumption of commodities has slowed, less demand for it. As for gold and the dollar is still looking pretty good against most foreign currencies as the world's reserve currency, and contrary to opinion, central banks are still buying us.
Well, speaking of a foreign currency and foreign central banks, Jim, for the dollar to truly be able to collapse, wouldn't there have to be some kind of other alternative for these dollar investors to go to? So I know that the dollar collapse proponents are really pushing gold as the alternative for these dollar investors, but is that realistic?
I don't think so. Right now, the U.S. dollar makes up about, it's been in the 61-62% of official foreign exchange reserves. And the closest competitor to the dollar is the euro, which makes up about roughly about 25%. So after that, it's the British pound, which is about 4%. So it seems pretty obvious there isn't a viable alternative to the dollar right now. Now, that's not to say that somewhere down the future there will be, but it'll probably be some sort of global currency. But I'd be pretty hard to force 60% of the world's foreign currency reserves into another currency. It wouldn't happen with the Swiss franc, wouldn't happen with the Japanese yen. They're in the process of depreciating the yen. And it's not going to happen in the Chinese yuan. So they're not even close to being even large enough in terms of the size of their capital market to hold that kind of investment. And the same thing goes for gold. I can't see a successful recalibration of the value of ounces of gold above ground to make it a viable replacement.
So you're essentially saying that you can't, at least not right now, you can't see a replacement for the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, which means essentially that if something happens with the dollar, it really behooves the foreign banks and foreign exchange systems to prop up our dollar if it looks like it was going to collapse, right?
Well, that's what we saw the entire last decade. You know, you take a look at it. The U.S. is still representative of about almost 22-23% of the world's GDP. There's no other market in the world in terms of size, depth, scope, and governance that even comes close to the U.S. market. So I just don't see anything replacing it.
I know that we have a lot of people that have these dollar crash portfolios that are holding assets on foreign exchanges, or they're holding these foreign companies in an attempt to sort of protect themselves from a dollar collapse. Can you talk a little bit about that approach in terms of a dollar collapse portfolio?
Well, let's talk about it. It happened in 2008, and it showed us pretty clear that if the U.S. has trouble, the whole world has trouble. So owning foreign companies or being in foreign exchanges, believe it or not, as bad as it was here in 2008, it was actually worse in emerging markets and elsewhere around the world. So it isn't going to isolate you from dollar troubles. It's like when the U.S. sneezes, the whole world catches a cold. And again, it could change if the U.S.'s percentage of GDP dramatically changes. But for right now, our economy is still in a growth phase. It may be slower than we normally experience, but that's because we're going through a deleveraging process in a period of financial repression, very much like we did coming out of World War II.
So basically, the U.S. is growing, but it's growing a little bit slowly. I know that for our investors that are coming to us with these dollar collapse portfolios, they're also very heavily invested in commodities overall. Well, their reasoning is that if there's a problem with the dollar and the dollar collapses, that means paper money systems fail. So holding tangibles like commodities is supposed to also protect you from these problems with fiat currency systems.
Doesn't work that way. When you get in a financial downturn, I don't care if it's 2000 or it's the year 2007 to 2009, what happens in a financial downturn or a crash, people start getting liquid. Hedge funds, institutions get margin calls. They start liquidating, and they're liquidating anything they can get their hands on. I don't care if it's commodities, and if the economy goes into a downturn, which it would, in a major crash or a catastrophe, that would mean there would be less demand for commodities. And so you're more likely to get a brief period or maybe even a longer period of deflation, which we actually experienced in the fall of 2008. We actually had a contracting money supply, and we actually had negative CPI for about 3 months. Didn't last long because the Fed and the government stepped up to the plate with a lot of money. But you could get a short-term deflationary period of time, which may even last longer, like the Great Depression, which would be negative for commodities as it was in 2007, 2008, and 2009.
Well, speaking about these portfolios with these exposures to foreign companies and foreign currencies and to commodities as a way of hedging against a dollar crash, I'd like to actually share with our listeners an example of a couple we recently met with who had a portfolio that was prepping for a dollar crash and sort of go over how we address those concerns with them. So we met recently with Phil and Emily King, and like many of you, they've been listening to the podcast for quite some time. They're in their late 40s. They did marry pretty young, so their kids are already out of the house. They're grown, don't have to worry about putting them through college anymore, don't have to worry about paying for weddings, all that's taken care of. So for a long time, their family had been running a small air conditioning business, which they recently sold several years ago. And since that time, they've been working for some larger manufacturing companies, and they're pretty lucky in the fact that some of these large manufacturing companies are still offering benefits that go beyond a 401k. So if Phil and Emily stick with these larger companies they're working with right now, the chances are they're going to get some kind of retirement benefit above and beyond their 401k, which is a pretty nice feature for those of you still approaching your retirement years. And Phil and Emily did come to us. We talked a little bit about retirement, but the more we talked, we realized that their main concern was looking at their portfolio. They really wanted an investment review. Like a lot of our listeners, and we're no exception to that, they feel like the U.S. is in pretty bad shape right now. And so they're really concerned and pretty convinced a dollar collapse is coming soon. And their portfolio really reflects that. So of their $1 million in their portfolio, roughly half was in bullion and precious metals investments. And what was on the other half of their portfolio, they had a little cash stash, which is smart. You should always have a cash stash. But the remainder of the other 50% of their portfolio was in foreign companies, or it was on companies traded on foreign exchanges. But mostly, Jim, it was invested in commodities. And as you can imagine, this type of portfolio has really been struggling since late 07. And the reason they came to us is they said, we keep thinking that this dollar collapse is going to happen, but it's not happening. You know, am I okay to reconfigure my portfolio to do something else except for prep for a dollar collapse? So we decided to meet with them and help them figure out what should they do with this dollar collapse portfolio to make it a little bit more realistic for the present.
And one of the first things that we did in their review, and you've heard me talk about this on the air, and it's not just me. We've had some pretty bright people on this show, Dr. Mark Faber, Felix Zuloff, and I've yet, Kathleen, to hear one of these guys come in and say, put 50% of your portfolio in bullion or the majority of your portfolio in bullion. So our first suggestion to them was to reduce their metals exposure since they were significantly, in this case, overallocated, not just their metals portion, but, you know, the whole portfolio was weighted towards commodities. So we suggest that they sell on any upswings over the next 2 to 3 years, try to reach an overall household allocation of something of no more than 20%, which even Dr. Mark Faber and others have said for many families is really on the high side. 5% for some would be appropriate. It really depends on a person's risk balance. I favor a little bit more than 5%, but, you know, everybody's a little different. But this rebalances the metals so that the metals position size is more suitable as an inflation hedge. Now, we also suggested that they refocus their approach to international investing by looking for companies with attractive foreign earnings patterns. In other words, I can own Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola gets about 75% of its sales overseas. Likewise with McDonald's. So rather than just holding foreign-owned companies, if you're trying to get away from the U.S. dollar, does it really do you any good to own a Chinese company whose revenues are 75% from U.S. sales? You know, it just doesn't make sense. So we encourage them to look at some of the large-cap multinational companies we call autonomies who are growing their exposure to not only markets that are developed, like Europe, the U.S., and Japan, but also they're growing their stake into foreign economies in the emerging world. I often talk about Coca-Cola on this program. It's an example of a company that is a U.S. entity, but it's really a global company. Coca-Cola has more assets overseas, gets more sales overseas, has more employees overseas. So if you missed my recent podcast, especially the one I did, I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, on autonomies or companies that act like nation states, I think the autonomies are a powerful example of a way to invest internationally, even though you might be owning a U.S. company.
So in addition to asking them to reduce their metals exposure and to rethink their approach to international investing, we also really encourage them to think about investing in areas that make sense given where the economy and the markets are now or might be in the near term. And Jim, this is kind of where the sector rotation comes in. So rather than holding on to this dollar crash philosophy for another 5 years and wait for the dollar collapse to happen, we suggested that they re-review what's going on with the economy and the markets right now and see if the economic indicators and market return patterns, you know, if those make sense to keep holding on this dollar crash portfolio. From our perspective, not so much. Really encouraging them to do some sector rotation and to really be more flexible with their approach to their portfolio. And that's pretty much how we manage our own clients' portfolios here, Jim, is that we keep a weather eye out on the storm signals for any major market problems that might be coming or financial distress that might be starting to brew. But in the meantime, while we're keeping our long distance eyes focused on what's happening in the long term, we're also keeping a near distance view too about what's going on with the markets and the economy right now, next 3 months, next 6 months, next year, and deciding what to do with the portfolios based on those horizons as well. And I know Phil in particular, the husband, was really worried about this approach. He was really worried about what would happen if inflation kicked in.
And I think a lot of the dollar class proponents think of the Weimar Republic. But remember, the Weimar Republic was not a world's reserve currency, and the situation was a lot different. So I like to pull from that example because the Deutschmark lost value, and the German stock market rose. It was at the number 97 in January 1919. It peaked at 26,890,000 in November of 1923. So if you're talking about hyperinflation, it's one of the things that we've been talking about in this program over the last 3 or 4 years with all the Fed's money printing. We've been in favor of blue chip stocks. And if you go back to Germany, which was an extreme case of hyperinflation, and we could probably use Argentina, Russia, Turkey, more recent examples, stocks are a good hedge against currency problems. Now, they're not a perfect hedge, but certain sectors are particularly affected by inflation and economic cycles. So you always want to be watching for those changes and what areas of the market are performing. If you take a look at what just happened from March of 2009, the bottom of the crisis, what's been the number one performing asset? It hasn't been gold. It's been stocks. So if there was a dollar collapse and the U.S. economy began to struggle, the longer term effects would certainly be a reduction in the consumption of commodities. Folks, if the economy's in a recession or worse, a depression, people aren't buying stuff. They're buying less of it. And if they're buying less of it, there's probably more supply of it, and the price of that stuff drops. So other companies that produce goods that we make use regardless of an economic situation, think of consumer staples, think of utilities, may actually continue to do well. And that's what happens usually when you get into a market top. Money starts rotating into those safe areas of the market. And that's why we were suggesting for the Kings, in a dollar collapse, or let's take, for example, a dicey economic environment, commodities aren't going to be the best area. Investments in, let's say, solid companies that produce things that we have to have. Think of the stuff that you buy. You're not going to say to yourself, well, gosh, I'm going to stop buying food because the economy's weak, or gosh, you know, I'm worried about the dollar, or worried what the Fed's going to do, or worried about foreign central banks. I'm not going to buy toilet paper, toothpaste. Even in tough times, we still buy that. During the Great Depression, people bought Coca-Cola. Coke paid a dividend through the entire Great Depression, and they still do today. Now, I want to clarify this. There is no guarantee they will hold up as well in the future, but it's my opinion that this type of investment made a lot more sense for the Kings.
So I think the Kings pretty much showed us, Jim, that there are other options for people who are worried about a dollar collapse. Even if we personally here at the firm don't feel that current conditions don't really point to a dollar collapse, at least not in the immediate future.
That's right. Once again, remember what happens if you get a crash, a stock market crash. Usually you get those kind of things following a downturn in the economy. What happens in a downturn in an economy? The economy slows down. People lose jobs. They consume less. The companies produce less. They cut back on production, which means less demand for commodities. Or taking a look at foreign companies likely isn't the answer. It didn't work in 2008, and it certainly didn't work in the year 2000.
Well, Jim, I'm really hoping, and it sounds like the Kings are going to let us readjust their portfolio a little bit. So hopefully it'll start to perform a little bit better. Why don't we talk a little bit about the next section of the program? I know we've had a lot of guests recently on Lifetime Income that are giving our listeners tips about lifestyle. Why do we bother with this?
Well, I'm a big believer in taking care of yourself. When you think about what we're doing in this program, we're talking about lifetime income, preparing for retirement. What good is it if you worked your entire working career, saving, putting money aside, investing, and you built up this sum of money that you want to sit back and relax and enjoy if you lost your health? So, you know, if you think about taking care of yourself in the long run, it tends to lead to, number one, better health, lower medical expenses, and a longer lifespan. So we tend to focus mostly on lowering medical expenses, since it affects retirement planning calculations and one that most people forget to plan on. But we're assuming most of our listeners might be interested in improving their health. Coming up next is my discussion with Carolyn Rosenblatt. She's author of the book, The Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents, coming up right after this. Joining me on the program is Carolyn Rosenblatt. She is a nurse, attorney, and mediator. She's also the author of the book, The Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents, a help for those who are taking on the caregiver role in their lives. She will also be co-authoring the book, Guide to Elder Mediation. Carolyn, one of the issues that often comes up as parents age, sometimes you get into issues of dementia, Alzheimer's. There's all kinds of issues that come up. What are the most prominent issues that you see and have to deal with on a constant basis?
Well, as you know, I'm in the consulting business, so people call with questions or come in with questions a lot. And I would say that the most frequent areas of problem come from two things. One, concerns about finances, and two, concerns about the role of taking care of the aging parent.
And when you run into finances, is it they're spending down their money? All you need is one serious medical illness. And if it isn't fully covered, that can go through a bank account very quickly.
Oh, absolutely. But I think more than illness, it's really the failure to anticipate that caregiving is going to be necessary for most people by the time they get to be, say, 80, and the failure to plan for that expense. It's just something that people don't want to face.
And lack of planning, you know, this is one of the issues that we see in retirement planning. People think about putting money aside and meeting their basic living needs when they retire. So, you know, you think of mortgages, house payments, food. They don't think of long-term care or serious illness, do they?
Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons that it becomes such a problem for the adult children is that the parent, even if they're starting to be impaired with Alzheimer's disease or any other form of dementia, or even if they're just becoming physically impaired, they do not want to yield control. They're terrified of giving up control over their lives. So they see addressing the issue of the possible need for caregiving or even planning for being potentially infirm and needing someone to help them as just awful and not something that they want to face.
Yeah, I had a client who had a parent that was in serious illness, was dying of a disease, and they had set up a trust, but she had not put the assets in the trust, which would have gone through probate. And when the kids tried to get involved and make sure that, you know, mom signed the forms to deed the assets to the trust to avoid probate, she refused to do it because she thought the kids were trying to take control over the assets. Is this something you also see as well?
Oh, yes. I've actually seen people end up having to go to court over that very thing, where they just didn't get the paperwork signed, and then the person loses capacity later on, that is, capacity for making financial and other decisions, and it forces the kids to have to get a lawyer and spend a lot of money on getting a conservatorship over them. And it's tragic. I think that certainly the parents may resist, but I do think there are a lot of things that the adult children can do to help them get to the place where they can make peace with this weird question they have, which is, you know, are they really trying to manipulate me? Are they really trying to take over? And the truth is, sometimes kids are trying to take over and are trying to manipulate, but that's not most of the time.
Yeah, because we do run into cases today where you run into elder abuse, where kids are taking advantage of, let's say, a surviving spouse. We run across this more and more these days, and especially over the last decade.
Yeah, it's horrible. And I think a lot of it has to do with where the economy went, and that a lot of people who are, say, baby boomer age have not realized their hopes in terms of what they hope to accomplish financially. Maybe they've lost a job. Maybe their savings were eroded by either investments that went south or by needs they didn't expect to have. And they then are very tempted to look at what a parent has, figure somehow that they are entitled to this, and they do terrible things to parents. I have one case that I've been asked to look at now, which unfortunately I don't think I can do very much about, but this woman who's now 88 and has dementia is still living in the family home. About 10 years ago, she deeded the home over to her son because she was starting to have trouble keeping track of things. And, you know, I'm sure in her mind, he was going to take care of her at home with his wife. She could live there for the rest of her life. She wouldn't have given him the title to her home if she thought he was going to dump her in a nursing home. But that's exactly what's about to happen.
Wow. In that kind of case where it's done like that, there's not really much that can be done, is there?
Not after the fact, but there's certainly advanced planning techniques that a competent financial professional and an competent estate planning attorney can set up so that at the very minimum, the woman has a life estate in her own home and she cannot be thrown out, and that the asset that the home represents can be used to pay for whatever care she requires.
If you were to have an ideal world where you were counseling, let's say, some boomers regarding their parents, they see that their parents are getting older, aging, maybe aren't as quick thinking as they used to be, or even worse, they see the beginning signs of dementia and Alzheimer's. How would you approach this?
The first thing I would want for adult children to understand is that they are going to have to be responsible most of the time in some way for helping their aging parents as they get older. And that is because of the infirmities that accompany aging. There are something like 5.5 million people in this country who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and that doesn't count probably millions more who have never been officially diagnosed. When the first signs appear, it's important to do the things you need to do. The first one is to make sure that you have the legal documents in place. There needs to be a trust if they own anything, a house, for example, assets, a bank account, any investments, and whatever can be put in the trust not only keeps them out of probate, but it protects the elder when they become disabled in some way, mentally, cognitively, because there is a successor trustee set up. And if that happens to be the spouse who is equally impaired, there is typically another successor, which would usually be one of the adult children, who can take over and keep that parent or those parents from financial ruin by overseeing what they're doing. That part is really important, and it requires legal planning.
And you just said a key word there, planning. And that struck me, and something we always recommend is planning. So there has to be some forethought, some planning done, because the last thing you want to do is get caught in an emergency situation, or even worse, you find something out and it's too late. And, you know, the person's incapacitated, so they don't have the legal capacity to start signing documents or do things that are necessary.
That's right. They can't sign anything once they get past the point where they're really able to understand the consequences of what they're doing. You know, it's pretty loose if you're talking about setting up a will or trust, because we call that testamentary capacity. And, you know, the courts are very generous with that. You don't really have to understand every dollar you've got. You don't have to have a clear idea about how the bank account works or the level of your mortgage. But you just have to understand generally what you have and who you want to give it to. And that's sort of oversimplifying this concept of testamentary capacity. But beyond that, there is this notion of financial capacity, which is way more complicated. And that is really about the ability to understand what you're doing with your assets, your money, your house, anything that you own, and all of the nuances of the consequences of decisions that you make. And that means being able to look at a checkbook and understand what's in it. That means being able to understand how your mortgage works. That means being able to understand that if you only have a certain amount in the bank, you cannot afford to be donating six-figure amounts to local charities because you're going to run out of money. And those are some of the things involved in this concept of financial capacity.
Carolyn, what about the idea of a corporate trustee? You mentioned a situation where a woman donated her house or put it in her son's name thinking that he would take care of her, and obviously that's not what he did. What about a corporate trustee to sort of ensure that things are going to be done legitimately and nobody's going to be taken advantage. How do you feel about that?
I think it's fine. I think that people underutilize fiduciaries, licensed professional fiduciaries who can serve as trustees. A lot of these estates are not so big. They consist of primarily the home and some other assets, maybe an IRA or KEO or something. But if the family can't get along or there's any doubt that the parent can trust any of the adult children who might be placed in charge, then it makes sense to use a neutral outside person whose obligation is to protect the trust assets and carry out whatever the terms of the trust are. In this instance that I mentioned, the story of this 88-year-old, the house was not in a trust. She just gave it to her son. It was a horrible move, and he has betrayed, I think, her belief in him because he is just getting ready to, you know, move in, remodel a house, kick his mother out, and gee, that's too bad because most of her cash is gone.
When you're putting together these legal documents and you're doing some planning, are there any kind of counseling advice that you could give to overcome objections? I mentioned the fact where a particular client was dying of a disease, had a trust set up, but the trust was not funded. And as the children got involved to try to get that done before she passed on, it really began sort of as an issue. Oh, they're trying to take control. Are there ways to approach this that makes it much easier and maybe takes away some of the fears?
Yes. I think one of the most important things, one of the most fundamental things, is the trust and communication within the family. A lot of intergenerational wealth transfers fail because of a breakdown of trust and communication in the family. You start with the estate planning attorney or the financial advisor or both. Each of those individuals has a tremendous opportunity to facilitate communication. And the first pushback you get on that, the lawyer says, well, my duty is to my client and, you know, I can't talk to the kids. Well, yes, you can if there is a waiver of confidentiality and if the adult, the elder, gives permission for the lawyer to communicate about the estate plan, the trust, whatever, with the adult children present, that's fine. That's a matter of communication. And the same with the financial advisor. The financial advisor is in a wonderful position to educate the heirs, the potential heirs, about what's there and help prepare them to manage it. If that managing it means getting the house set up to take care of mom or dad should they need extra help, then that's part of the education process. But I think both professions back away from these intergenerational conversations because of this privacy consideration, which to me is very easy to overcome with the permission of the person who's got the estate in the first place.
So if you're approaching a delicate situation like this, is that where someone like yourself comes in and mediates? You can come in as a neutral party to come in and say, look, really, putting the assets in the trust, getting a corporate trustee, that's really going to protect you.
Sure. That's part of what we do here at agingparents.com. I work with my husband, who is a clinical psychologist, and we not only mediate family conflicts, but we give a lot of advice. We help people who are just sort of struggling with an issue to kind of get through the hurdles that are blocking them from accomplishing the ideal outcome that they want to have. And we do that through meetings. We do that through telephone conferences. We do that sometimes on Skype, getting people together who are scattered across the country. But it is worth the investment that people make in that little bit of advice, because if you think about the cost of, let's say, the dire consequence of having to go to court and get a conservatorship, you can spend $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 in a fight over a conservatorship in this state. Whereas if you spend far less than that on getting some competent advice to help you at the front end, you're never going to have that conflict and you will not need a conservatorship.
You know, as you take a look at some of these issues, once again, it gets back to a planning issue. Most people, when they get ready to retire, they're thinking of putting money away, you know, a place that they want to live. Maybe they're going to sell the big house, buy a smaller house, move closer to the kids. Is this the time really when you're thinking of getting ready to retire to put all these issues into a plan? So you've got the estate planning documents if you need, you know, you've got some kind of financial arrangements to take care of, such as a serious illness. Maybe it's Medigap insurance. Maybe it's annuities for long-term care or long-term care policy. But also there's sort of a plan of action, a step, so that let's say mom and dad live in Florida, the kids are all over the country, something happens to one spouse and surviving spouse is incapacitated, there's sort of a playbook, sort of a plan. You know where the assets are, because one of the things that we find, Carolyn, sometimes is we just went through this issue with a client where the husband handled the finances. They lived in a retirement home, which was nice. So they had the medical care, they had the finances. But after he passed away, we found assets, brokerage accounts, places where he stored bullion, bank accounts, all kinds of things that the surviving spouse wasn't even aware of.
Exactly. And that's a nightmare for people. And again, it starts with the fundamental need to communicate about what you've got, where it is, and what you want to do with it. And it has to go beyond the estate plan that the lawyer creates to the education of the family. Now, the elder who handled all the money really had a duty, if he wanted things to go well, to make sure that not only his spouse, but the adult children knew where everything was and what the estate really consisted of. And not being secretive about this, because secrecy is a great way to make sure it all falls apart and creates a problem for people after you're gone. But, you know, we're kind of a death-phobic society. We don't want to think we're going to die, and so people avoid this. And the consequence is just what you saw. It's a mess.
Is that more, Carolyn, a generational issue? I know a lot of the greatest generation were very circumspect about divulging financial information. It was kept private.
Yeah.
You take a look at the younger generations today that, my goodness, you take a look at Facebook, Twitter, they want you to know everything about them and what they're doing.
Right. But the problem is that the people who lived through the Great Depression are the ones who are now still holding some of the wealth that is supposed to comprise the greatest transfer of wealth in our country's history. So this privacy, being circumspect issue is still a difficulty. I think that elders who have money and intend to leave something to their heirs really need to have the assurance of the heirs that they're not trying to manipulate or control or force anything to happen, that they simply want to protect the parents, that they want to honor their wishes, their values, their long-term goals for whatever inheritance is intended, and that they will do what they can to assist and prevent the abuse or misuse of any part of that estate. But that conversation doesn't take place very easily, and a lot of people need help. And, of course, that's something that we do here is to help facilitate those conversations. But I think that it's a common problem that people have difficulty in even discussing these things.
You know, the ideal situation, I would think, too, Carolyn, would be if you're setting up this plan, you've got the attorney involved with putting together the legal documents. You may have a financial planner or investment advisor. Maybe sometimes an accountant if there's complicated tax issues. But it seems like the ideal thing would be to have a meeting with the advisors and the family so everybody knows they're on the same page and you can have input from various people that will be involved in the estate.
Absolutely. That's really something that we advocate. And, you know, with technology being what it is, you can have a Google Hangout, you can have a Skype conversation, you can do this by video conferencing. There are a lot of ways to make this easier for people so that you don't have to have everybody fly in from out of state and converge, although face-to-face, of course, is ideal. And if the estate is large enough that there are going to be a lot of educational needs that the heirs have to make best use of the assets, then you definitely need to have more than one meeting. The planning is really more of a process than a single event. But I think what you're suggesting, of course, is something that we are totally behind here at agingparents.com, because we don't like to see people fail and not make it for lack of the know-how about communicating about planning and actually doing the planning itself.
Yeah, in the age that we live in now, you have, with the internet, you have things like GoToMeeting, you have Skype.
Right.
So even if mom and dad or the kids are in different states, different time zones, it's possible to bring everybody together.
Sure, and we've done that with mediation too. We had one mediation here at the office with the elder, two adult children in the room, and then three other adult children in different states were on Skype video on split screen so that everyone could see everyone and hear one another as well. And we did get that matter resolved.
If you were to describe an ideal situation in terms of planning for these kind of issues, whether it's estate planning, incapacity, final distribution, how would that process look?
I think the first thing is that the adult children may need to be the ones to initiate, because as you say, a lot of people in the greatest generation are a little bit hesitant about revealing what they have for fear of being taken advantage of or because of their history during the era when they grew up, it was not considered polite to talk about money. So if the adult children initiate a conversation about planning for the future, then they've got to pick a time. And the point of retirement or the 65th birthday or the 60th birthday or the 70th birthday or some marker that is important to the parents, I think is a good time to start doing that sort of planning. And then I think the preparation for such a meeting or planning process begins with collecting information. The financial advisor, investment advisor, is an ideal person to provide a summary of what there is because they usually know a lot about what there is. They may not know about things like real estate investments or family-owned businesses, but they know about the invested assets. And that data can be summarized and provided in reports so that people have access to them. Then I think the process includes getting waivers of confidentiality from the financial advisor and possibly from the attorney who's done the estate planning or is in the process of updating the estate plan so that those individuals are comfortable knowing that they have their client's permission to share what would otherwise be private information that they're not allowed to share. Then I think some sort of agenda for the planning process needs to take place. What is the purpose? What is it the elders are willing to share in terms of information? What is the outcome that they want to see as a result of this planning? And if they are able to articulate that by themselves, that's great. But if they are not able to articulate that without help, then I would say getting somebody like one of us at agingparents.com or some other trusted person to help them develop an agenda would be great. Then I think the next thing is to get meetings on the calendar and get people together and begin to communicate. And one of the fundamental steps in that communication process is really defining what the mission is. If the parents own things, do they want to see that used by their heirs for doing good in the world, for educating grandchildren, for creating a legacy of some kind that they define? Whatever the mission is becomes a primary part of the planning process and actually drives the action. And then once that is defined, I think the people involved in this go through deciding what the best outcome would look like and how to get there. And that would be it.
Let's talk about your book, which is The Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents. Tell us what's in it and how it would be helpful in addressing maybe some of the issues that we're talking about here.
Sure. It's a basic book that I wrote in response to the fact that a lot of people were calling with questions, and some of these questions were redundant questions. And also, I looked at my background and what I know. I was a litigator for 27 years, and I represented people who had gotten injured, most of those people in car accidents. And some of those car accidents were caused by elderly drivers who shouldn't have been on the road. So the first chapter was how to handle a dangerous older driver. And then I go through a lot of other parts. There are 9 chapters, all of which are available separately. And we have it in audiobook, and we have it in PDF that's downloadable, and it's in print. It's on iTunes kind of thing, but we want people to have access to a reference book. All of the chapters are pretty short, but they give basic information. For example, there's a chapter on how to handle money for aging loved ones. And we talk about the durable power of attorney, what you can and can't do with it, why you need one, and what your obligations are if that becomes your job to have that responsibility. So we cover a lot of different areas, but we cover them in a basic way so that if somebody doesn't understand anything about this and this job of being a caregiver or being in charge is thrust upon them, they will have some place to start.
And Carolyn, as we close, why don't you tell people about your website, where you blog, and once again, I'm going to mention the name of your book. It's called The Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents, a help for those who are taking on the caregiver role in their lives. And that's by Carolyn Rosenblatt. And Carolyn, tell about your blog. You blog for Forbes, so if our listeners would like to follow the work and the issues you cover.
Sure. I was invited to blog on Forbes as a result of writing several articles for them. And the articles cover a lot of subjects that have to do with boomer issues. The blog is called Aging Parents. And Aging Parents covers not only issues that affect elders and those who love and care for them, but also there's another aspect, which is healthy aging. And that's my favorite, I think. That's the most fun part because I get to talk about exercise and nutrition and things that interest a nurse and things that interest a person like me who's very determined to have the healthiest possible senior years that I can. So that is it. Our website, agingparents.com, is designed to help people get information. First of all, the products that we have, which include the book and webinars. We have a YouTube channel, Aging Parents, and that gives little brief videos on things like what's the power of attorney or how do I talk to somebody with dementia. And my husband, the psychologist, Dr. Davis, and I both contribute to those. And we have a blog on our website, too, and it reflects sometimes the content that has been published on Forbes earlier. But really, it's a general information site, a place to get a consultation with experts in the field, and a place where people can purchase downloadable or print products as well.
Well, listen, Carolyn, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. Very good information and issues. Once again, you know, the one great thing about our healthcare system is with knowledge, science, and the technological advances, we're living longer. But as a result of that, we're running into the very kind of issues that you and I were talking about.
That's right. And I think it's wonderful that you have a program that helps people access information in an easy way from someone with your knowledge. And I appreciate the opportunity to join you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you're listening to this program, hope you had a wonderful Christmas time spent with family and hope that you didn't eat too much and you're feeling okay. We'll be back again next week with another reprise program. Next week, we're going to be talking about how to choose a financial planner and a guest from Peter Gravitt, who's Secretary of the California Department of Veteran Affairs, as I will be talking with him on so many things and so many benefits that are out there for you veterans that have served our country. And hopefully you can take advantage of these, from medical care to home care to schooling, insurance, and other areas. That'll be coming up on next week's program, which will be 2014. So until then, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.